When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Are you troubled by stale podcasts in the middle of the night?
Do you love films that feature the busting of spooks, specters, or ghosts?
If the answer is yes, then don't wait another minute.
Ghostbusters Resurrection is an RPG audio drama combining tabletop gaming and cinematic paranormal elimination adventures.
Call the professionals at nerdyshow.com/ghostbusters.
We are ready to believe you.
The following program is presented by the Nerdy Show Podcast Network, geeky programming for all nerds across the multiverse. All Nerdy Show programming is made possible by the generous support of listeners like you. To learn how you can support this and other fine geek programming, visit nerdyshow.com. All right, so welcome to the first design episode we've done since the end of Chapter 1. Yeah, so Chapter 1 has ended. I hope you guys had a great time listening to it if you listened to the play episodes. But Liam is picking up the torch next, and next week we're going to have a Session 0 out where you hear us create our characters and that kind of thing. Doug's in it.
I think it's going to be fun. I think I'm going to have a lot of fun doing it.
No, I'm going to have a lot of fun playing it.
And by the way, it's me, Doug, and Liam tonight. Max can't make it, so I don't know if we're going to start a Max Watch, but
let's talk about Max Watch.
All the shitty talks about Doug Watch, there's been a few episodes I've been here. He hasn't been here.
That's today he's whittling, and whittling is an all-day event.
So, Doug, are you excited to play this game?
Yeah, like, legit. Like, I mean, when we sat down to do Session Zero, I had a vague idea of what I wanted to do, and I didn't know anything about what Liam had planned. I mean, as we sat down and started to explore the characters, like, every good Session Zero, it gets you pumped to play it, which is why we talked about Session Zero, like, last time. It's like, you gotta do it.
I had several ideas of what I wanted to do throughout all of them.
Same. Yeah. What I brought to the table, what I thought I wanted to be like use a rapier sword and be almost like musketeer-like out the window completely.
One, your characters seem so much fun, but that's not even what I was most impressed with or most happy with. The idea that you invented this former leader, the idea that you made a party dynamic that already has internal conflict, but similar goals. So, like,
well, we're all natural kind of storytellers, so we sought that out, I think.
Yeah, there's a lot of room for minor character conflict that won't become a major mainstay of whatever plot's going on. Thank you, because that makes the planning phase a lot easier, which I'm having a lot of fun doing that. And I'm like on my third draft of my initial box tech.
I mean, I don't want to speak for everybody, but I think as far as like players, you may have it fairly easy compared to most people because no matter what you do, we're going to find fun. Like, we're going to build our own story regardless.
We're on board.
Yeah.
I mean, 100%. Yeah.
Cap is the largest wild card at this point.
Only because you haven't really played with her before.
Yeah, and her experience playing RPGs is in a different lane than what we're going for.
Yeah. Sure.
Because we could go light on the mechanics for Cap and produce a similar experience, but that's not our goal. We are making a game that has to work mechanically.
Sure.
I'll talk about GMing for a little bit. I just finished a 14-part run, which would be the equivalent of like a book one of an adventure path or a module, if you're using D&D terms. And it was fun. Obviously, I did not prepare it pre-written in the way that you would get that content if you bought it outright. But it gave me a lot of insight into how they're made and the things I wish I could have had on hand at the time that I didn't, that I had to randomly generate.
Or had to deal with literal rule changes as we were going on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's probably an added level of difficulty.
But I want to talk about prep. Doug has made 3 seasons of Ghostbusters as the Ghostmaster, the GM of that.
And a couple of one-shots for Nerdy Show as well.
Mm-hmm. Liam was Doug's first GM ever.
Mm. Why popped your cherry?
The eyebrows you gave me. No one's going to see the eyebrows, but I mean, you need to know, he gave me the eyebrows.
And I've run 2 long-form games, one for Liam and then one for Liam and Doug with other friends. And it was just the two of us sitting across from each other like that Fear of Girls short film. But there's a lot of prep that goes into it, and we've only done homebrew. I mean, we don't have a lot of adventure module stuff. And now that like I'm more familiar with playing them and that kind of thing, like I do enjoy it. And I do see how it frees up a GM to not spend so much time at the table coming up with rules and answers to things. Although there is kind of beauty in those moments as well.
Sure.
Oh, some of those are my favorite.
So I want to talk about prep a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm going to, while Liam GM's next, then it's Max, and then...
Maybe me.
Maybe Doug.
God, I want it. I want it so hard.
All right. I got an idea I'm kicking around, but you've
never been my GM, and I've listened to you GM another game, and legitimately been jealous of some of the stories you told about, like, prep work or the questionnaire you gave.
Oh, yeah.
Or even that story. I'm like, oh, that's brilliant.
I can send you the questionnaire if you want to take it.
I don't. I don't need to know that about me.
Yeah, okay.
I'm a worse person than I think I am, and I need to keep that true.
The questionnaire is not...
It's not about you.
It's not about you.
All right.
It's like, look at these pictures. Pick one. And you're like,
I don't want any of them. And it requires you to pick one.
Yeah. The amount of prep work that I put into a campaign, I'm almost embarrassed of how little it is. Like if I had to,
are you joking?
I'm not joking. It seems like I'm preparing a lot because we're doing so much of things related to the campaign in these design episodes. But my actual prep work before I'm going to run a campaign is I have an idea of like a twist.
Uh-huh.
And then I write like maybe three or four events that are very simple. And then when we do a session zero, after you guys create your characters, I try to get another couple ideas. And then all I do is worry about week to week. Before we play in one session, I will create an encounter using a random number generator and then adjust the numbers till they look more appropriate. And I'll name them something. And then when you guys go to encounter them, if it's appropriate for you guys to fight something, I will often alter what it was you were going to fight into what you are now fighting. And that's it. Everything else I try to do on the fly.
That seems very reasonable. Like, I want a percentage of total playtime for a week boiled down to your, like, compared to your prep time.
Oh, my prep time is very low.
For a 2.5 hour session, 30 minutes?
It's hard to say that way because, so sometimes, especially at the end there, when there's a lot of dialogue, where more I have things that needs to come across, I need to sit down and actually write it out. But even then, it seems like a lot of effort was put into it. But what's needed is so specific that as soon as I start writing, it comes out because it needs to be something to fulfill this next thing.
I'm totally okay with that because I've definitely heard stories of people saying, like, however long we play, I put in about that much time in prep. And I'm like, ooh.
Yeah, not even close.
I think there's a problem with it, your system or your party if you're hitting that level. Either you can't rely on them to cut you some slack, or you're writing a novel and they're just there.
There is a certain joy many GMs get out of over prepping, where they're like, oh, well, it could be this, or it could be this, or it could be that. And they just write things out. And, oh, if they go down this door, I'll reveal this excellent thing I prepared. And if they never do, they're not actually that bothered by it because they just enjoy that part of it. It's not me. I'm a little more utilitarian about this kind of thing.
Everything you're saying is making me feel even weirder. Like, not because I'm one way or the other, but because I'm a strange mix of both and I can't fully explain why.
Like, oh, no, that sounds maybe the most preferable.
Yeah. Like, I tend to over-prepare mentally, but if you look at, like, the paper that I bring with me, it's just bullet points.
Yeah.
So it's like, on one hand, like, for example, if we're doing Ghostbusters Resurrection and we're doing Season 2, I based every location you guys went to on a real location. I researched the fuck out of those locations and, like, wanted to be like, if I was there, what would I see? What would it feel like? What would it smell like? I did deep Wikipedia dives on all that shit because it was, quote-unquote, based in reality. But once we got to the table, I felt armed with all of this knowledge of, like, exactly what the environment was so that I would have an answer for you to bounce around in.
Well, you do have a distinct advantage where your game setting takes place in an alternate version of our reality. Yeah. So you can actually...
research it.
Yeah, you can just type in the name of a location we're going to go to and find out information about that location. Right. We don't have that luxury.
Right. You know, and that's what's a little intimidating about me running the game. It's like, I got to make it all up from scratch. Oh, boy. Even though it's the title
it's
of the
in the
show.
Name, yeah.
I know.
I want to know what Doug thinks about Erd.
I got an idea, but we'll have to get there. That's, you know.
I'm looking forward to it.
I know.
I'm going to make a dumb, broken character in the worst way.
Well, we'll deal with that when we get to it.
I want to make a purposefully bad character.
My general thing is, it's weird here. You're like, oh yeah, I sort of underprepare. That's my guilty thing. I'm like, I overprepare for every session. Like for when you're doing like a campaign, you're building the world or whatever. Mm-hmm. I'm like, okay, I want these six things to happen. I'm not married to like, it has to happen exactly here or exactly there, but they'll happen when you guys, because you guys determine the pace. I just figure out the world, but it's always the player's job to figure out how fast or how slow they get to a thing.
Mm-hmm.
But for every individual session, I tend to overprepare. So it's weird that when building the entire campaign, I do very little. But when it comes to each week, I want to have so many answers. But I know that you always have more answers than players are ever going to ask.
That's the way to be, yeah.
Right. But using that gives me the confidence that I need to sit at the table and say, ask me literally anything and I'll try to give you an answer. There's only been, in my memory, there's only been one time where I wrote out what a character would say. And I won't say what it is, but there's an episode towards the end of season 3 when you guys were doing a thing, talking to a certain someone, and you probably noticed because I literally didn't look at anybody and I just read my paper in front of me of mm-hmm. what this person said.
Right.
But everything else was always just sort of off the cuff because I overprepared so much. I knew what this character would say given almost any circumstance.
It's interesting because I definitely, way more than that, have written out entire lines of dialogue and conversations between NPCs. That you guys encounter in Echoes of the Starcrash.
Oh, yeah. Dialogue is actually the thing that I am the most concerned about being precise with. Because I feel like most of the characterization that you get from NPCs is through that way. And it's also the main mode of the conveyance of purposefully not rolled for information. Like, because they can mess up rolls and then not know things. I always fret over that. But like box text in conversations, I always like to be a little fluid with combat and have like release valves. If it's going poorly, I can do this. Or if they're just steamrolling it, mm-hmm. like here's how I bump it up. Mm-hmm. I like having things staged out to be reactive.
Well, here's a spoiler alert. Already in our system, that's easier to do.
Oh, no.
You can probably tell a couple times where it happened.
I already built the first encounter. I was gonna be like, okay.
Because boss fights and enemies are able to act multiple times around, and you can split their actions into several different things. It sounds like it makes things more complicated, but it makes your life so much easier. Because you could have a huge attack, but it doesn't have to be so huge that it's threatening. You can smooth out their damage among an entire round, and it's great. You don't have to worry about one-shotting everybody.
Oh, and even in designing boss encounters, well, the first leg of its turn around, it does something aggressive, and then it does something buffy, and then it does something protective. And you can kind of wrap your head around its strategy
mm-hmm.
that way, and I really like it, rather than being like, oh, this happened, now it has to do something aggressive, and your players can't read it. Where, like, it almost feels a little more Dark Souls-y, mm-hmm. where, like, it's more about strategy and pattern recognition,
sure,
rather than just straight numbers.
Yeah, and that was one of the things. So in the boss fight at the end of Echoes of the Star Crypt, he had this ritual that would throw javelins at people. He never even got to use it because Obed rolled so high on his magic check to understand what would happen, and it said, yeah, if he takes damage over a certain amount, it goes away because he has to use part of it maintaining it. And I wasn't even mad when it failed before it really got to ramp up, because it was going to ramp up every round.
Oh, it's going to be terrible.
Yeah. So I had that in mind, that ritual would fail if you surpassed a certain criteria. And also, when he gets to half health, the golems go away, he gets ice armor, and any melee attack done against him, he can teleport.
Which is a son of a bitch.
Right, but you have to have hit him, which yeah. is still like, well, I'm glad I hit him. You know. Mm-hmm. So it didn't plan out to where that became a slog, you know, with those abilities coming in, because in the first round, he lost those javelins.
I think it was 2 rounds, then golems. It wasn't long.
When he got knocked under half health, so he had 100 health total.
Yeah.
And when he got under 50, he gained armor. He gained 6 armor. But before he got to act again, he was down to 30.
Was that just teamwork, or because of the damage was just so strong?
Both. I mean, it was teamwork setting up that damage.
Obed set it up understanding what was going on. I knocked out the javelins. As soon as the javelins were knocked out,
he lost one of his turns per round.
Essentially. And then we got to concentrate fire. The melee characters concentrated on his golems. And then, like, range just started hammering him. Mm-hmm. Going
and
hard.
Galen ran in and brought him solo with Helmet mm-hmm. Splitter.
Yeah. And then he did an area effect thing that made a big area of difficult terrain.
Basically.
And then I destroyed most of it.
Okay.
In like two turns, it was mostly cleared. Mm-hmm. And then melee characters just got in, surrounded him. He got hit once, teleported, and then was like done flat out.
Yeah.
It's something I've been learning as a GM, especially since I started to play for different people. Like we went to the convention and we played with different people and I GM'd for strangers and doing different campaigns in different games. It starts to feel very one-sided when you have like four or five people at the table.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, well, I got, and it's not even like a thing of jealousy or like envy, like, oh, I made this monster and they don't really understand and he didn't even get to do a special thing, but it's just sort of like, man, it really does kind of feel stacked against you when it's like you have one thing and they make a move or even two moves per round and then you got to just take those fucking hits. Because I'm going to put it out there. As far as video games are concerned, JRPGs are not my thing. Right. I hate turn-based games. And I remember when you were first trying to convince me to go play Liam's game and you were talking about how D&D goes. And I'm like, but it's like a JRPG where it's like turn-based. You're like, yeah, but it's really good. I'm like, but I hate that. I don't want to take a turn and wait for someone to fight. But when you're at the table, for some reason, it just felt different.
You don't feel like you're waiting around. Well, okay, right. I have felt that I've been waiting around.
In some cases, you're literally waiting around because people don't know what they're doing. But it's like time slows down so much, it doesn't seem to matter. Whereas when I'm playing a video game.
And also, like, they're doing their turn and you're commenting on it. Like, you're in
trouble.
Sure. Or even just being like, oh, they did this thing. Okay, now my options changed. Here's where I'm at. We're like, I know I just described this fight and it seems pretty one-sided. And in recapping it, it does feel that way. But literally every turn, everyone was like on edge. Where a dice roll.
Well, he opened up with max damage against Keith.
Oh, yeah. Dropped him.
Wow.
He dropped first hit. It was crazy.
It wasn't the first hit. Second hit, yeah.
And that's not to say that means players are overpowered. It's just that when you're waiting and you just have to take those hits, you know, it's like...
That's the main benefit of what I've enjoyed about this boss fight system. Calavon had three turns around. In his case, he had also two golems, but they acted on his turn.
Yeah.
I did not feel like I would go, then all of them would go, and then he would get to go again.
That spreading out gives you a lot of room to breathe, I think, more than anything else. It doesn't increase your damage. It doesn't affect the numbers at all, but it allows you to parse out what happens. Where, like, in other editions of Dungeons & Dragons, dragons just get to do, like, seven fucking things on their turn, and they get to do a breath weapon, and then a claw attack, and then every once in a while they get to do a tail attack.
It's like an unreasonable challenge.
Oh, and then you realize on their turn they can do like 70 or 80 damage. Where like if they fixate on the wrong target at the wrong time, there is no recourse.
Right,
nothing to do, and your agency is kind of.
Yeah,
but spreading it out, it's like, okay, that guy got hit. I'm going to do something defensive instead of offensive this turn, or someone's going to move in my way, or someone's going to try and distract him or do this, or we can get a heal off. Limiting the burst damage of bosses feels like a step in the right direction.
So Liam, you're prepping a campaign. You're starting off.
Yep.
Blank slate. We've got some hint as to how it starts.
Yeah.
That's it. How do you actually physically start prepping?
Location descriptions, especially basic ones.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, do you use it like physically? Like, do you use a notebook? Okay.
No, I have to write it out. I sit down and I just start writing down location descriptions in a notebook that I know I'm not going to use. These are base notes. This is a first draft. It's purposefully a first draft.
But it's easier to remember them if you've written them.
When I sit down and start typing stuff up, I can look at this and go like, ah, oh, it's a bad word choice. Or like, this sounds confusing now that I'm reading it back. Usually if I bring something to a table and I've had 2 weeks to prepare, I've gone through three revisions. And I start whittling down to like, what's important to the player? What would they actually notice? What is useful? And three revisions is my sweet spot.
Okay. Well, what about you, Doug? How do you use a computer? What do you do?
Do you mean like for just a campaign or for a session?
Campaign.
For an entire campaign, I heavily rely on the computer. I probably should do more handwritten stuff like Liam, because I find that when I'm writing by hand, I unlock a thing in my hand that it just keeps writing.
Likewise, yeah, for sure.
But for whatever reason, I always start blank document, and it sounds hokey or too formulaic, but just to get me going, I write down bullet points 1 through 12, and I go to Joseph Campbell, Hero's Journey, 12 things, and my idea behind that is not everything must conform to the format of whatever, but rather
a skeleton.
Yeah, just but even the bare bones, so that you can look at it at a glance and say, does this even feel like a story? Does this even feel like a thing? Or is it just random shit, you know? Mm. And then once it feels like, okay, no, there's a story here, then I can throw it out the window and say, let's fill it in with meat. Like, let's explore whatever. And so I'll go from the bullet points and just start doing it. And then I start to ask myself, like, all right, well, what do I want the characters to go through? Like, what the players, rather. Like, what do I want the players to go through? Is this about scaring people? Is this about being funny with a twist, or
is this about being heroic? Is this right. about being yeah. nasty? Are these assassins? Are these bad
guys? Are they supposed to feel helpless? Are they supposed to feel heroic? You know, what can I do to make them feel these things? And I'll be like, okay, well, I want to have if they're supposed to feel heroic, let me have a really tough fight, but a really grateful people respond. Right.
Yeah.
And then, you know, and you can't just always have the same thing over and over again. So you have to have
some Batman moments.
Yeah.
Where, like, maybe they're unhappy you saved them.
Sure, sure. Or whatever. But just to give it variety. And it's like a roller coaster up and down of, like, whatever. But I heavily rely on Google Docs. Everything is basically on sure. Google Docs these days. I'll often listen to music or I spend way too much time bullshitting on, like, Spotify with playlists of, like, what I want, you know, whatever.
This is a total tangent. But have you ever wanted to work with someone and then you start having the conversation? It's like, I'll just share with that with you on Google Docs. And they're mm-hmm. like, oh, I don't use that. And then you're me like, now I'm rethinking this whole endeavor because you just made it way more work.
No, because I totally understand that point. But for me, it's like, oh, you don't know the beauty of Google Docs or Google Drive. Yeah. Let me show you how easy your life is going to become. So far, it's worked for the better. But I can imagine if you've had an experience, then yeah, no.
No, I've had people are like, oh, let's, you know, we're going to write like 4 5-minute like web series shorts that we're gonna shoot,
and they're gonna email you yeah. a Word document. Fuck that.
No, yeah, they're like, oh, Google Docs. I'll just share it with you.
We all have the exact same document,
and yeah. I'll present my outlines, and yeah. this will be fine. And then I can even attach pictures of shot lists that I'm drawn up, and they're like,
whatever. Fuck that. They don't.
Yeah,
they,
no,
they
don't like, have,
they're not they collaborating.
Don't, yeah, and if like, they don't know how to so organize much, their shit, then you don't want them. Yeah, they're crazy makers.
It becomes a situation where setting up my stuff to send to them becomes a fourth of the effort that yeah, I'm putting forth is like you're redefining it every time or importing and exporting. And they're like, what's the current version? And I'm like, everyone has this stupid email address on Gmail. You have it. It's there somewhere. You just don't want to look at it.
Yeah. As far as like building an entire campaign, basically it's all on Google Docs. I'll basically make one Google Doc of what I consider the story outline for the entire campaign. Mm-hmm. And then I'll do separate Google Docs for each individual session. And I'll often go back and modify that main storyline document as players go on and make things or make suggestions or that they meet a character they like. But yeah, I don't know what else to say other than I just make a lot of lists and a lot of outlines over and over and over mm-hmm. again. It's nothing but lists and outlines. And then it just becomes more and more fine-tuned to like, here's a list and outline for a month in-game. Here's a list and outline for in game time, it's like maybe 2 hours, and it's just a list of sequence of events. But it's always loose and bullet points and open to interpretation.
Doug and I have worked together. We've written 2 screenplays. We've collaborated on a bunch of things. So it probably doesn't come as a surprise.
They've
to
done
him.
Road trips, yeah. which I think is just as important.
I don't think it comes as a surprise to Doug that I always start off with a bulleted list, and then I write the ending where I'm like, this thing will explode.
Yeah.
And then I'm like, and then I write the thing ahead of it, and I'm like, they meet in a tavern, and yeah. then I just start filling stuff in the middle. Mm-hmm. Then I abandon it.
Yeah.
Because I cannot control where you guys will go, and I don't want to.
I do have a question about that. Now that the first, I guess, season? Are we going to call it season?
Chapter,
yeah.
How wildly different did the experience end up compared to your, I mean, I guess not ideal, but your
original intent?
My vision of it?
Yeah.
That's hard to say because I just wrote they're in a missile silo and they take off in a rocket at the end. I didn't know
all right.
who they would meet. I didn't know how it would go.
So like Forsha didn't exist until Forsha existed?
I created Forsha in session 1.
Okay.
I didn't know that Forsha would be possessed or anything like that going in. It's just things that you guys did kind of led me in that direction. Mm-hmm. Not as a result of your character's actions, just of like the sentiment of the way the campaign was going. Mm. I did not have a very clear picture of the final moment or what things would matter to your characters emotionally because I didn't know. I had no idea what you guys would latch on to.
It played out well. I really think it did.
But, I mean, that's because it was adapting to what you were doing at the time. You guys did something one episode. I write it down. I'm like, okay, all right, well, can I think of a fun way to bring this character back? Or what's a new problem I can introduce that they'll care about based like on how they reacted for this other thing?
Bolivo.
Yeah, Bolivo.
Was brought back. I have a tiny bird apprentice that's very important to me. That stuff counts, man. That's actually...
You're both making me feel like I'm doing my thing the wrong way.
No.
Because I ridiculously over-prepare. I sit at the table. It all goes out the window. And then everything the players do nudges everything. Like course correcting on a ship. Just one notch, and it's going to end up totally different. So I'm always over-preparing and constantly throwing it out. And I feel like that's a waste of time.
I'm always prepared for a hard left turn. You guys took in the first session, like the first campaign we were in, you took two... heavy.
I remember one very clearly.
Yeah.
But you took,
because we'll bring it up at any given opportunity.
Yeah. You took two heavy left turns where I was like, I guess the story I was telling doesn't matter anymore. Yeah. You were supposed to go to a new continent. There was supposed to be this whole thing. There was a big MacGuffin that was destroyed immediately. Yeah. And then another thing that was supposed to cause a civil war, you just flattened.
Yeah.
And you were being like, no civil war. That guy who is supposed to be important is dead now. I was like, oh, I guess this doesn't happen. I guess you killed Robert E. Lee in his crib. Great job.
Well, but...
So I ran with it, and it was awesome.
Yeah, but that's the thing. It became... It's unforgettable now. That's the thing.
It's unforgettable to me, because I was being like, the next day I woke up, I was like, oh, what do they do now? I don't know.
But take some solace in the fact that we recognize how awesome that was.
Oh, no. No, I took immediate satisfaction in it, because the thing to do it was insane. It looked so unlikely.
For listeners, there was a magic sword that none of us wanted.
That was the MacGuffin of this
campaign. One ring to rule them all.
It was literally that.
Yeah.
And my character had some knowledge of how to make.
Because you were raised by dwarves.
Yeah, how to make weapons and magic.
Yeah, you had
weapons.
A crafting skill.
And it was like, who wants to carry this thing?
And nobody.
And it was like, do we even want to have it leave this cave? Because as soon as we step out of this cave.
Yeah, this thing shouldn't exist.
We have a target on our backs.
And you knew that immediately.
It, the world's over.
You knew that immediately. Yeah. That it was like, this thing sucks.
Yeah, so I said, well, if I roll my crafting, would I know how to just destroy it or dismantle it? And Liam's like, no, it's totally outside of your thing. And Doug goes, what if he rolls 320s in a row? And Liam goes, if he rolls 320s in a row, fine. And we're like, okay. And I had the big flashing D20.
The one that flashes.
Yeah.
And I roll the first one, 20. And like from that moment, you're like, game on. Like,
that wasn't a serious thing that could happen.
No, it was a
until
joke.
That first one, you're like,
suddenly it became real.
Yeah. There's a 20 and it started flashing. And we're like, okay, how does this go? Shake it. Roll again. 20. And we're flashing. And everybody's like, oh, no.
And here's the thing. At that moment, I was still like, no way. Yeah. There's no way.
Yeah.
Three, no.
Mathematically, no
Even
way.
The two, super unlikely. But you know what? I've seen good runs.
Mm-hmm.
But I've never seen three in a row good run.
That back close together, back to back from one player.
Never seen it.
Yeah.
And then third 20 in a row. Flash and people got up and they're like, ah!
Yeah. Broke my game.
Yeah.
Broke the whole game.
You dropped your notebook and you threw your pencil across the room.
Yeah.
There were six pages.
Yeah.
There were six pages that were torn out the next day because they didn't exist.
I remember,
afterwards, somebody, I don't remember who, was like, Josh, throw it again. Just see if you can get four. And I did.
He did.
Yeah. It was a four. Yeah. And by the way, I know anybody who listened to this is like, loaded dice or wasn't throwing it.
No,
you guys were both at the table.
No.
100% legit.
Oh, yeah.
And you weren't underhanding it.
No,
nothing.
Also, I've seen that dice land.
Yeah,
badly.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I've seen it, done it. But it was definitely that thing of like the whole plot. Literally, the big bad of that game could never ever be released ever for any reason, unless I just decided that moment didn't matter.
And I
didn't want to do it because it was too cool.
It's funny because already your guys' reaction to this implies a different GMing style than mine.
Mm-hmm.
Because they'd be like, yeah, you break it and it's awesome. And I'd be like, okay, cool. I still know how this campaign is going to end and where they're going to go. Like in my head, I'm like, that's still. So now all I'm going to do is make it like, oh, that's a plot point that this thing is destroyed now. And who cares that it's destroyed? I'll make up somebody. And then I would just roll from there.
I've never quite put myself in that position. I mean, but that's the thing. It led to an amazing game experience I'm never going to forget.
Yeah.
But I've never allowed my players to immediately upend literally everything I've done.
It literally changed who the major antagonist of the entire campaign.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction and free shipping. And that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Yeah. So, I make bullet points.
You make bullet points.
I make bullet points.
And bullets.
And then I don't reference them again. Mm-hmm. And then from session to session, I remember what the next plot point is, and I try to create scenarios that if you're making your notes session to session, you know what your players' characters care about. So it's not so much railroading as it is like, yeah, let's give them what they want.
Nudging.
In this direction.
I like to think of... Because I don't like to think that I'm railroading people, but I do have an end in mind. Mm-hmm. So I think of it more as like that Wallace and Gromit short with the wrong trousers where he's just planting the rails immediately in front of the speeding train.
Right.
That's more what, like what it feels like to me as opposed to like, oh no, you can't deviate from this path.
I like that metaphor immediately because the thing I don't like about the concept of railroading is that the GM is the one in control.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're on a speeding train and your players are the one
falling forward,
shoving coal into the furnace as fast and as hard as they can, they don't care that they're on rails at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can get to that point, you're great. And then also if they take a left turn, if they're already hucking along and on board for the ride, they'll turn right back onto the track you're on and have no complaints.
So here's something I kind of want to put out to our listeners is if you guys want to see the kind of notes I keep from session to session, the latter half of Echoes of the Starcrypt I've been tracking, I've got a little iPad that I write on, and I can export those as images or PDFs or something like that. So if that's something you're interested in, let us know. I'll send you everything I've got. I don't think they're particularly that interesting, but if you have no idea where to start GMing and you think you're not very good at it or something like that, let us know, and I'll share that with you, and you can feel a lot better about yourself.
Might be kind of encouraging to like listen to an episode of Echoes from the Starcrypt, read the notes that you had in front of you, and say, well, if he can do that, I could do that.
So I kind of want to get back into magic, because I was happy with the discussion that we had about divination magic.
Uh-huh.
And just using the example of predicting the weather being a baseline. The mechanic solutions we're coming up with, where you only spend momentum or you do this and that, they're so clunky. And I feel like if we know what we want magic to do, let's worry about the mechanics afterwards. Because right now we're bolting on a magic system and we're trying to fit it into existing mechanics. I think there needs to be a clear vision of what magic can do for players before we start talking about its difficulty. In a pure numbers sense.
I'm very comfortable doing that. I do want momentum to be involved somehow.
Sure. So we talked about divination primarily in terms of the weather. Now I was thinking for behavioral things, charm person, that we can call that soul magic. And that can affect a number of things. So it's not illusion. So right now we have soul, which is affects people's behavior or makes them...
Emotion-based kind of?
Yeah. Affects them as a person in ways. Like
at a core.
Makes them rage. Makes them not recognize a friend.
Fall in love.
Fall in love. That it's true.
I think that's on the quid pro quo list.
That one's
NPCs,
probably illegal.
NPCs you can do it too.
So is soul magic in general more illegal than the others?
I think it's, 100%.
Oh, no. It's tantamount to necromancy, almost.
But, like, as a bard, you wouldn't want to dip into that to get the crowd
pumped. You would, but you're not going to tell anybody.
Yeah, but it would be, like, illicit drugs. Like, it's a thing you can find, but you have to know somebody who knows somebody who knows somebody to even start that conversation.
But it could be even, like, what's the smallest soul magic. Because last time we said you want to know the weather in the next three hours is the smallest divination that you would do. The smallest soul magic would be like, you make somebody feel good.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would just say
that, like, that's or, a small
or bad.
Yeah, either.
But very mild.
But the easiest thing would be to make someone feel good. It's easier to make someone feel good than probably than to feel bad. Unless you, because, well, unless you
I think
say,
it would be the same.
But yeah, just a minor mood change.
Yeah.
Yeah. But if it, well, because, like, I feel like if you were going to make someone feel bad, what's the simplest would make someone feel bad? Well, you punch them or you do something physical.
Oh, I think that's.
But to make someone feel good, if you just smile or you, like, you tell a joke, it seems a little more.
They're just more likely to buy your story. Like, it gives you a bonus for diplomacy checks, that kind of thing against this person.
How about this? It doesn't change their mood. It changes their receptiveness to stimuli.
That's, yeah, that's a good way of putting it.
Where it's easier to put them in a bad mood if you, like, slight them. Mm-hmm. Or if you do smile, even if it's something that would they would generally just go like, ah, whatever. And they're like, oh, okay.
You seem really affable,
so it's,
friendly.
So it's, yeah.
It's a response to you, not necessarily the world in general.
Well, it's their ability to be responsive to stimuli. Mm-hmm. Minor things that would not make their day can in either direction.
So here's other things, too. You can calm somebody.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They hate you. They want to fight you. And maybe they still hate you and want they still hate you, but the urge to fight you vanishes.
Yeah.
Yeah, right? Sure.
Or you could enrage somebody, which is just the opposite of that.
Sure.
I do think we're going to be talking a lot about formalistic dichotomies in soul magic more than anything else, maybe?
I don't think so. I think in these early tiers, yes, but let me explain why.
As soon as it becomes a direct command,
there's no opposite.
Yeah, there is no opposite.
Protecting against this kind of thing,
uh-huh.
Probably soul magic. If you want to kind of gird your mental loins, mm-hmm. is that soul magic?
Yeah.
Right?
Psychics protect against psychics. Yeah.
I think to keep it simple, sure, but I feel like you could, to make it simple for people who aren't in the soul magic thing but want to be protected, like amulets and rings and totems.
But they are imbued
with
a ritual that you've
You
got
to get someone who knows what they're doing to imbue it.
Right.
I almost want the defense against a thing to be broader. You can also just do basic defense.
Sure.
There should be a basic magical defense.
I think we actually talked about that. Protection magic is.
Yeah. Should be basically, someone can be like, oh, you're defensed against soul magic this heavy. Oh, I just have a basic protection spell as well.
Right. This might be whatever, but could it be that the higher intelligence you have, the more baseline protection you may have against it?
I think that's already the case.
Yeah.
Would it be composure? I think it depends on the spell.
Okay.
If you're trying to enrage somebody, you're moving against their composure.
Sure. Yeah.
If you're trying to confuse somebody, it goes against their intelligence.
Yes.
Yeah.
So
would any of that be against endurance or strength or dexterity instead?
For soul magic, no.
Okay. Illusions maybe, though?
I think illusions goes against your intelligence more than anything.
All right.
In other words, if you have a high enough intelligence, you may not even need to know how to buff yourself against soul magic. I mean,
or composure.
So, yeah.
For instance.
Where you're like, I'm under the influence of a drug. I'm able to, if not negate that effect, I'm at least aware of it.
Let's say there's a group of people who've never encountered a con man. Mm-hmm. Con man comes in, gives you his whole spiel. Somebody who's smarter is kind of figuring out what's happening, even though they don't have previous experience.
Sure.
So that would be intelligence.
Yeah.
Good mood, bad mood, calm, enrage. What else? What other kind
ingratiate?
Of... Ingratiate? I feel like that's almost like good mood. Instead of calming, enrages, or good and bad mood, we would say change their... Dungeons & Dragons and Pathfinder uses a mechanic where there are tiers of hostility.
Okay.
So it's like friendly, indifferent, unfriendly, hostile. And what you do is you shift their perception of you in certain...
On that line.
Yeah, along that line. That's okay. I don't know that I really want to get into that very much. I think if you just make it so that your check is more likely to succeed.
Yeah.
If you're more likely to convince them, that's fine. Because I think like if somebody is...
It's a modifier.
Yeah, because if they are... You let the GM scale up how unlikely they are to be affected by your argument. Where this is a plus 15 because this person has excellent knowledge of the subject.
Would it just make them more receptive?
Yeah, I think it would make them more receptive specifically to you. In that case, what would you call it? That would be charm, really. Like, not in the way... So, if you take D&D and Pathfinder terminology out of it. So, charm in D&D and Pathfinder is they become your friend, even if they're an enemy. We're saying you are using magical charm to just make it more likely that people will do that.
You become more likable or hateable.
So what's the opposite of charm?
Disgust?
Yeah, there's another word for that, though.
Rancor?
Distaste.
Ooh.
Distaste is pretty good.
I like that.
Yeah.
That's nuanced.
Yeah. And open to interpretation.
Yes. Okay. Which is important for rituals, I think.
So you can make somebody distasteful. Distaste when dealing with that. It's a clunky word to use, but it actually, the sentiment is right on the money.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And like, yeah, I found him rather distasteful. Or
offend is the opposite of charm.
Ooh, I like that actually a lot. Offend, I like.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because that is...
You make somebody more offensive.
Yes.
Okay, so we've got alter their mood to be slightly better, slightly worse. You can calm them or you can enrage them.
Yep.
You can charm them or offend them. Now are we in that...
We're in inception mode now.
Yeah. So now the next level of that, I think, might be they feel affection towards you, like in a friendly way.
Yeah.
Like you charm them so well that they...
Yeah. And charm is the word that the other systems use, but that's not actually... You haven't charmed them. You have made them view you as somebody you're not.
This word isn't great, but I was thinking like enchant.
I don't think it's someone that they're not. It's that they view your, like, the things that are positive about you are accentuated to the point of insanity.
Infatuation?
Yeah, infatuation. I like that. Like, you're not someone that you're not. They now require you.
Seduce is really...
Is nice.
It's more appropriate, except for its sexual connotation.
I like infatuation better.
But even infatuation means that they are, in some sense, obsessed with you, which is not actually what we mean.
Yeah. Okay.
Like a seduction, if someone seduces you, you're not infatuated with them.
No.
You might be, but
you
it's
might
not.
You might be, but it's not one and the same.
Entrance?
Ooh, I like that.
But that implies a trance.
Yeah.
Like you're comatose or something.
Same with mystified or...
That's why I like enchant, but in a world full of magic, that's...
Enchant has a different connotation.
Yeah.
Beguiled?
That's almost like you don't need magic for that.
Befriend? That would be closer, right? Like you are...
Ingratiate?
That's not bad,
that's
but
solid.
It sounds
it's
like...
clunky.
That's on the... Path,
it's
though.
Close. It's close. Because ingratiate sounds like you've done something for this person, and that's not what we're talking about. Enthrall.
That seems harsher.
Enthrall sounds like they're your slave.
Yeah.
So maybe that's the next level where you command them. You're enthralled them.
Well, they'll do what you say just out of...
Yeah. You know. You've given them a command. I have the perfect word, but the association with D&D and Pathfinder may harm it.
All right.
Wow. Cleave. Cleave has two meanings.
All right.
Cleave means to join or to break apart. So to cleave,
to cleave
somebody to you.
Let's look at join then.
Well, that's what I'm saying. We use both. We can use this tier is cleave. You cleave
join
them apart
or separate.
Cleave them too.
I like it.
I just think you have to remind people that it means also to join, because I think if for people thinking they're going to think of a cleaver, which
sure.
is a cutter,
yeah. which yeah. is a separator.
No, yeah. and that's fine, because you know what we can do, put a footnote.
Sure, no, sure, sure.
But
sure.
they
I'm
also may think of cleavage, which is joining.
Yeah.
Kind of blew my mind. I never thought about that.
Yeah. Cleave has two meanings, and they are antonyms.
I thought it was cleavage because it was they're separate.
There's a name for words
Not
that are
joined.
Their own antonyms.
So, oh, here's a good one. Sanctioned.
Yes.
That's a good one. Like, you could sanction it means you approve, mm-hmm. or it's sanctioned meaning...
Meaning you're not allowed to have it.
Yeah, exactly. Dust means there's dust, or you are
dusting.
Like, getting rid of it.
Oh, yeah, it's a dust.
Oh, what's, there's another one. Shelling.
Yeah.
Putting shells on
or removing
the
shells.
Oh. Trim. Cleave. Oh, cleave's in this list.
Yeah.
Is it Janus words?
It might be Janus, yeah.
Yeah, Janus words.
Janus is the Greek god of hallways, pathways, and connections.
And judgments. The idea is he has two faces, two minds about everything. Okay.
Oh, like Janus films.
And yes. Janet
two faces.
Janitor actually comes from it. The guardian of the hallways.
Hmm. Okay, so cleave. So we've got good mood, bad mood, calm and rage, charm, offend, cleave. It means to or from.
Uh-huh.
After that, it's got to be enthrall.
Yeah.
Where they are at your command.
Or repelled?
They're not enraptured by you. No. I think enthrall is enough.
Enough?
They're just going to obey you.
Yeah.
And then after that, I think love?
Yeah.
After Enthrall? Like, what's after Enthrall?
I'm almost thinking infatuated.
Enamored?
Actually, I'm gonna say, because I feel like love feels genuine, infatuation feels false. They feel loving feelings, but I feel like love is always, at its core, should be a two-way street.
There's unrequited love.
Yeah. That's true, but that's a specific type. You have to denotate unrequited.
So...
But to the person loving it, it's just fucking love.
I want to take a left turn here. What is it to corrupt somebody?
Oh, that's a hard question.
I signed up to make a game. I'm not here to answer big questions.
I think corruption and I'm not asking for synonyms.
I'm saying to corrupt somebody, to make them. Like, how does worm tongue work? You know what I mean? Like, what kind of soul magic is he using?
Maybe, again, this might be just too simple of an answer to jump to, but it's like to make you do something that you yourself would never choose to do, but you make that choice freely. Like, there's some, like, they either surround you with something.
To act in not your, like, not even your best interest.
To actively choose against yourself.
Your best interest.
Like, to actively choose against your own interest. And because here's the thing. If someone's in danger and you're going to run into a burning building, that's actively against your best interest, but you're heroic.
Okay. If you go up to an enemy.
Yeah.
Yes.
And you're like, you are now my best friend. Attack your allies because you want to defend me. Mm-hmm. I think that word is dominate.
Yes.
Yeah, that's better than corrupt. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Dominate actually is a spell in these things. Okay. And I think that's the full breadth.
I don't want to explore past that.
The other things I was thinking of all fall into illusion, where you see your friend differently. Or
it's
whatever.
A trick.
That's illusion. Yeah. It's a visual problem.
This is not based on perception. This is cognitively dealing with it differently, where the other one is presenting different information to you. Yeah.
Or if you say, I want your friend to appear like one of your specific enemies.
Yes. Illusion requires a lot more background information.
Well, because here's the truth of it. If I cast an illusion and your best friend looks like your most hated enemy,
and he speaks.
You're like, what are you doing here, bastard? And you're like, what are you talking about? I'm so-and-so. And he's like, well, you look like this. And he's like, well, not to me. Yeah. I don't know what you're talking about.
And you're like, clearly, tell me something only Kelton would know.
You're stupid. He's like, oh, okay.
Yeah, no, that's Kelton.
There must be some magic going on.
That isn't.
There was that new stranger in town who.
Yeah.
That isn't the strangest thing. We were in a rocket yesterday. Who cares?
I like it. Let's stop there for that one. I don't want to worry about the mechanics of this one because if we need to. Yeah. The number of people affected, the distance, all that. We kind of have
a scale
for that. Yeah. So, in regards to our damage scaling discussion, Doug wasn't here for that, but we've caught him up. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts on it? Good and bad?
Looking at it on the page. I just see a lot of numbers and letters, and I fucking hate algebra.
It's not algebra.
I know. But looking at it, it just triggers that thing in me where I'm like, what? I perpetually always want to make things simple. It's like just fucking simple as possible. Having said that, when I look at it more closely, I do see the through line. I was hesitant about using D20s at all, but that's so high level that it's like, dude, if you make a character that with that many steps. You've been playing for a long time.
Oh, I still hate it, and I will still.
I'm not going to do this.
My whole thing is if we come up with a better option eventually.
Sure, I'm open. I am open to whatever.
If D14, 16s, and 18s become more common,
I am open to other options. But I'm just saying, as far as like choosing the D20s, I don't think I hate the idea of using D20s as much as hating the idea that you've made a character that's that far along that's your only like recourse. You know, like, well, I'm level 75. I have 75 steps. Like, dude, you're not even Batman's not 75 steps down all that shit. You know,
I have larger questions about it. That steps taking down defensive or healing paths matter as much to your damage of your path as much as that. I think that's a larger conversation, and I don't think
that allows healing to scale.
I would argue that a doctor would know how to hurt you more than a normal person would.
Oh, that's true, but what about a tank?
What about a tank?
All right, so you get to a point where you have a damage based daily, and then you just go straight Citadel, and you scale just as well as someone who goes straight Damage.
Yeah, you go 75 steps. Well, I guess you've done it for so fucking long, you know what you're doing.
Here's the there's a direct advantage of the ability to use armor, the ability to gain more hit points a turn, and you still, not in your entirety, but for a single ability, you get to scale the same way. There is something in that that we can protect against and design around, and I'm not saying that any of this is broken, but we do need to be aware of that situation.
Here's my amelioration of that. Everybody's 12 steps in.
Yeah.
Okay? I go straight Citadel, 12 steps. The damage of my abilities isn't as big of a focus as it is for somebody who is champion.
Yes.
But the extra damage on their abilities is higher because it's multiplying and you know, it's been focused at higher tiers and mm-hmm. increasing their damage. I don't think it's a problem because every step we take, their damage gets even better.
Maybe.
Definitely.
I just thought of a question.
Sure.
Let's say I'm a ranged wizard.
Okay.
Glass cannon.
Yes. Right.
We've been playing a long time. I don't want anyone to ever touch me.
Yeah.
Okay. And good luck.
Yeah. No, but, I'm just saying. That's the goal I want to have.
Right.
And I'm always ranged. I'm always firing. Uh-huh. And my abilities get more powerful. Sure. Makes sense. Right. I'm like level 20, let's say, or 20 steps. Does this mean if someone steps to me and I do an unarmed punch, what am I rolling on that if I never had to throw a punch before?
So punches, unarmed, let's make it a dagger because I think I want to introduce some unique rules for unarmed combat.
Sure. Okay, but I was just saying like theoretically.
Let's say it's a dagger. You're 20 steps in.
Yeah. And let's say I've never
We can literally look this up.
I know. I'm just saying, let's say I've never stabbed anyone before.
Yes.
Because I've always been super lucky with my range. And my team is really good. They always protect me. This is the first time three people got knocked down. I'm just a wizard who's out of spells.
You're going to hear this number and you're not... You're going to be... It's going to be solid.
Mm-hmm.
It's not going to floor you.
Yeah, we had the same discussion with Liam mm-hmm. where he's like, well, let's say this. And then I give him the answer. He's like, oh, that's okay.
The option the option that I provided did work.
All right. I'm step 20 or 25.
My problem is that the different scaling of weapons, when you add three weapon, because of the dynamic range, especially of some of the reach weapons, is crazier.
Mm-hmm.
That might not scale, but if we make it flat and then we just provide a bonus,
right,
that solves that problem immediately.
I'm always looking for the loophole.
No, and you should. Lay it out for me number-wise. You're using a dagger.
Sure.
Because unarmed strikes, I want to do something unique with.
Okay.
But
a low level, a small weapon.
A tier one weapon, sure. Which is 1d4.
Yeah.
How far along are you?
Let's say 25.
Okay.
25?
Fuck it. Let's say 20. I don't care.
Like, 25 is heavy, dude.
Fine, 20. Let's just say 20.
25, you've completed two paths.
Yeah.
Let's just say 20 then.
Yeah, 20, 25, you're like straight
even 20,
fire,
I'm
straight ice.
Yeah, just 20, I'm already impressed. Let's just say 20.
Okay, you reach out
your
dagger.
There's still two paths, dude.
Yeah.
So you have completed two paths.
Mm-hmm.
You're a huge world-ending badass
mm-hmm.
twice over.
Mm-hmm.
Your dagger does 4d6 of damage.
That's big.
Yeah.
But here's the thing. What did you need to do to complete two full paths? You're Merlin.
Yeah.
So you are.
If Merlin never picked up a knife in his life,
if Merlin had to climb cliffs,
Merlin at this point has seen about 1,000 combats.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. So just
I get it. Sure. Sure.
He has barged down doors. Yeah. He has gone through torture. He has flayed dragons. He has seen the end of other worlds.
The average damage of his strike is 14
uh-huh.
at that level.
Uh-huh.
All right.
With a dagger.
Somebody using a hammer, a war hammer, two-handed. Let's say at fucking 20 steps?
20 steps. That's pretty dope.
What's their strength modifier? Like,
let's say 2.
Well, no, let's divide 20 by 3, so 18 by 3. So they've added 6.
Let's say 3. They're adding to endurance. They want more armor.
Maybe.
Here's the base.
You want armor.
Okay, so I'll just say I've increased it by 3. They started off with 3 in strength. They've added 3.
So they're at 6.
So they're at 6.
They counted double.
Hold on. I'm answering your question.
Okay.
So Warhammer at that level would be dealing 2d12 plus 1d8. Plus 12.
I guess the basis of my question
okay.
is, does it make sense you've completed two entire steps. Like you've done 20 steps, two classes of magic. Sure, your dagger, that sounds fine. But that same person can pick up a Warhammer mm-hmm. and do that much damage if they've never picked up a Warhammer before?
So let's take the step.
Well, no. I actually think the answer is definitely yes. Here's my reasoning. Merlin being your example.
Sure.
Merlin is my example. Thank you.
The end of La Mort d'Arthur, okay?
Uh-huh.
Before the end of it, there's some noble walking down the street. Mm-hmm. Somebody's going to stab this noble with a dagger. Mm-hmm. Who's more likely to do it correctly? Some street urchin who's never stabbed anybody before? Or Merlin. I think Merlin is going to get this.
But you're talking about the character of Merlin, as we know him, has probably handled a knife before. I'm talking about, going off the beaten path. I'm talking an extreme example.
All right.
A magic caster who's typically never had to use melee weapons.
I think they are so much better and more used to combat that the answer is definitely
in
yes.
In physical hardship.
To draw a mechanical analog, to complete two full paths is, you've played Dungeons & Dragons before. Mm-hmm. Imagine if your character was level 40. Mm-hmm. That's the equivalent that we're talking about.
Okay. If you're a medic for the Navy SEALs and you're like fucking 10-year vet and you've seen some shit, the first time you pick up a spear, you're going to be fucking King Leonidas with it?
You're going to be definitely more capable than any other...
More capable than me, no doubt. I'm just saying, that does it scale that much for a weapon that you've never held before?
I think so, yes.
When you start considering dailies and encounters, you can't do the crazy shit. You can't spin it around and bring it down your head and kill 30 people. But you can shove it at a dude.
If Michelangelo picks up Leonardo's swords, is he going to be as good as Leonardo?
We're talking about the painter or the...
I'm not the turtle, motherfucker.
No. All right. All right. Well, here's the thing.
No, hold on.
They've leveled just as much, haven't they? They've been in the same battles.
The answer is, okay, you are presenting it backwards. It is, if Michelangelo, after fighting alongside Leonardo for...
Exactly.
When he picks up Leonardo's sword, is he going to be better at it than somebody, it's their first day on the job? The answer is yes.
Sure.
Okay. Is he going to have all of Leonardo's cool-ass abilities?
No.
Absolutely not.
Yeah.
So that's what we're talking about.
Right.
So your experience makes you better at everything. But
sure.
But you do not... That doesn't mean that you get all of the cool shit. Like,
Okay, I'm starting to see what you're saying.
Right.
Okay. Because if you do said... If I say my main weapon is the spear, I'm going to take steps that are going to focus on making it even better.
Let's flip this around. You are 10 steps scoundrel, 10 steps champion. Mm-hmm. You take step one, fire. Your flaming lance is awesome.
Yeah,
does it even compare to my step 10 crazy daily? It doesn't, touch it.
I'm starting to see what you're saying, yeah.
But when we throw a firebolt,
it's better than rookie wizard day one throwing a firebolt.
Well, it shouldn't even be close.
And I wouldn't suggest that it should be the same as like literally, you know, dirt farmer comes to the adventure the first day, but rather like does it the sense of scale over time. It shouldn't. As long as Michelangelo doesn't pick up Leonardo's swords and is as good as sword
as long as
we're not doing that, then that's fine.
If Michelangelo and Leonardo both just pick up the sword and they're like, make a single slash, a single basic slash against this target, and they are the same amount of steps, they will make the same slash.
But Leonardo could do overwhelming strike every turn.
But here's the thing. That's the difference. And then they're like, go all out. And then Michelangelo would make that single slash.
Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, I would drop it.
Fair enough. Or you would bury the sword into the mannequin.
Yeah.
Using Liam's example, it's the one main reasons why I thought of this as a solution. If I get to step 12 and I go step one of some other path, that at will and that scene suck.
They're terrible.
Yeah. If I
you shouldn't be as weak as the first rookie, his first day on the job with
correct.
That shit.
Yeah. If I'm like, sense. Oh, well, I've done this so long and now I'm going step one fire.
Your fire shouldn't
a be. A D8 is not going to cut it.
Yeah.
After 12 steps.
Why would you ever want to multi-class?
Exactly.
Yeah.
So in that scenario, let's say you take 12 steps.
Yeah.
It does a D8, right?
You've taken like two Citadel and then 10 champions.
Yeah. To use the Turtles metaphor, I wasn't trying to suggest that Michelangelo couldn't even hold a sword.
Right.
He should still be able to be deadly.
But he doesn't have the features.
Right.
He doesn't have the abilities.
By the way, those are
do extra shit.
Those are the things that make this game right now. Yeah. Where, like, the reason why I'm an advantageous range character is his consistency of damage and his likelihood to hit, because he's literally built for that.
So I can dig it. Is it simple enough?
Great question.
That's the question.
Yeah. And I think there are things we can do to make it simpler. And one of the things is I made a prototype page 2 of the character sheet where it's along the bottom in rows of 10. If you say increase, so helmet splitter, we're tossing around the idea of it just increasing your damage by 20 tiers. You just move right twice. You see the dice that you're supposed to roll.
It allows for a lot of versatility. All right, I go core fire, step 1 fire, and then it turns out, you know what we really need more than anything else? We have a healer, we have a tank. Let's say we have someone who's decay, doing a great job, and I start going scoundrel. Should my fire abilities, should they atrophy? They wouldn't. I'd keep them in my back pocket. Mm. I'd get stronger. We're not talking about the increase of an ability, we're talking about the increase of a character.
That's a good way to put it. You've won me over this time.
Yeah. Okay, well, and let's flip it away from the player mm-hmm. side. Let's move it to GM side now.
And how this makes it easier to deal with?
It makes, if you're a GM, this tells you how many hit points to give your enemies. All of the characters that you're fighting against, their HP has increased by minimum 4 per step.
Yes.
The damage that the enemies deal increases at the same rate. It becomes a lot easier to manage. And I know this because I know that Liam probably noticed this in the final battle. Was the first time I implemented this.
Oh.
With Calavon.
I changed
his damage amounts.
It was great in one point and then sucked in another. It made him feel very dangerous. The only thing that sucked about it is he did the same thing that I did, but so much harder that there was some FOMO.
All right, well, that's all the time we have for today. I want to thank Liam and Doug for joining me. This has been a lot of fun and nitty-gritty shit. We're deep mm-hmm. in the woods. Next time, I kind of want to talk about... I want to get into fun stuff. I want to do another School of Magic and then get into Step 4.
That sounds awesome.
So,
well, we got to get to Step 12 at least now, because we've been talking about the damage getting that
that's
high.
That's right, that's right.
I really do feel like base game Step 12 should be our cap.
Max, yeah. Because you get a lot more per step, and it takes longer per
step. And that's divisible by 3. You have a base stat increase that fits in that realm. And also, I do want to recommend that most adventure paths or most games cease there, and then I want rules for other games.
Sure. I want to revisit the rule book and repurpose it in the sense of tiers for damage, for weapons and abilities. And I feel like that could be done pretty easily. So we'll get into that.
Yeah.
So thank you guys for joining us. We really appreciate you listening. We are on Patreon, where you can get the rule books, the character sheets, the cutting room floor, all the fun conversations. Don't make it to print at patreon.com/RPGFS. Join us on there. If you feel like commenting on something you heard, if the damage scaling discussion enrages you, please tell us why. We love hearing from our listeners. It's one of our great joys. We're also on a lot of other social media platforms.
We're on facebook.com/RPGFS.
We're also on Instagram at RPG from scratch, all one word.
We're also on Twitter. We are at Homebrew Hombres, plural. Thank you very much for listening. And until next time, stay safe, stand watch, and get a full rest.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.